This is a continuation of the interview with Dr. Edward Bowles on July 15th, 1987, tape two, side one. We'd like to begin our discussion now with a look at the origins of the microwave committee that was formed in 1940.
Good.
If you could describe the background to that and how you came to be affiliated with it.
We come to anchor ourselves at MIT. Bush, Vannevar Bush, whom we'll touch on him if we get back to MIT and my experience there. Bush was appointed chairman, I believe that was the term, of the Carnegie Institution in Washington. There's some points worth talking about later when we talk about MIT. He ambitious soul, and he was looking for something to do. One way or another, he conceived of what was termed in the rules and regulations of Washington, head of the NDRC, acronym for National Defense Research Committee, to obviate any ambiguities that later turned into the OSRD, the Office of Scientific Research and Development. For reasons I needn't go into at this point, I found myself a member of what was called the Microwave Committee. Bush's idea originally was to have it a detection committee. In other words, for underwater measurement, that is sonar, and above water measurement, radar. There was a tussle between the Bush-Compton complex and the Navy Department. They strenuously objected to opening up secrets on underwater sound detection to the microwave committee.
Was the Navy group led by Admiral Bowen? Would that be the person in charge of that group?
Excuse me.
Was the Navy group led by Admiral Bowen, B-O-W-E-N?
I know him well. Knew him well.
Was that the Navy group you're referring to?
I'm not referring to any individual in the Navy, but Bowen was an arch antagonist, not only against the idea of divulging the work the Navy was doing on sonar, but I have to say that he had a profound antipathy toward Bush. He was a man of not only decision, but looked on with respect in the Navy, as you may or may not know. And Compton was a gentle soul But he had virtually a religious or fanatical belief that science was the end-all to everything. Bush was an arrogant rascal along with his ability. And so the two of them joined hands against the Navy point of view about sonar. So it was about a year later before sonar was opened up for the NDRC. I say about a year. That was, we were permitted to get in on the radar work, such as it was, up to the time the committee was formed. But sonar was held out of reach in a security sense. Now, I was secretary of the Microwave Committee, and we have in the files all the material on that. The chairman was Alfred Loomis. Loomis was a part of the financial house of Thorne Loomis, T-H-O-R-N-E. He was an astute, I say rascal, but he was an artist without a good, an unsavory reputation in Wall Street. I base that not on my opinion, but on other material. And he had made himself a million or two, I don't know how many million. And in the course of this, like many moneyed people, before the Microwave Committee was established, he had occupied himself with the work of Ernest Lawrence at Caltech. Lawrence was working on the cyclotron, which that is going to be important to us before we get through. Now, as the committee was made up, presumably by the collaboration of Bush and Loomis, who was now to be chairman of the Microwave Committee, we had a representation from the Bell Laboratories. That was a man by the name of Bowne, B-O-W-N, B-O-W-N, a distinguished, call him a scientist, engineer, or what have you. He was a creative man at the forefront in the Bell Labs organization. There was a member from the General Electric Company. His name will come to me presently. I don't think it's a great moment. And there was a member from Westinghouse.
I think those, the first one was probably Metcalf. And
Metcalf, absolutely.
Hutchison.
And Hutchison of Westinghouse. And RCA, the first man was something like, not Bowne, but near there in name. And then it was changed to a much younger person presently. Now, that was the Microwave Committee. And we started out with meetings. Bush was pressing us to get to work while we were gyrating to try to arrive at a plan. This binder here is just as it was in Washington. It covers all the contracts that were made in that early period in my day. Loomis was not a man to fool around with paperwork. I forged his signature on almost every one of the contracts. That's incidental, but at least I'm guilty of setting up the wording and getting him ready to go to Bush as the high mogul in NDRC.
Let me just interject. Are all the contracts that you're referring to in this folder relate to microwave committee activities?
As it was, yes.
Not, it doesn't refer to any other contracts that you may have undertaken in relation to your other activities with Stimson?
Oh, no. That's way after this.
Okay.
Because I was fired from the microwave committee by Loomis after, in the spring of 42, because we'll get back to that when I talk about instrument landing. And instrument landing is a mechanism by which I met Admiral King, the future Admiral King and the future General Arnold before I got in to NDRC. Now, moving along, and I want to be interrupted at any time when you want me to piece in. We let these contracts through the medium of that committee, the membership of which I've mentioned to you. The first few contracts, and they're all in here. There's nothing else in here but the results of deliberation of the microwave committee. We started out with the rather loose idea that the thing of first importance was the what I called, in opposition to some of the Air Force young ones, restricted visibility fighters. In other words, the Air Corps had been brought up to think of the job as night fighters in terms of the bomb attacks on England. Now, we concluded, I'm talking about this original microwave committee, that with respect to what the Navy and the Army Air Corps were doing, we needed an independent function. In other words, instead of passing the buck and hoping the military would do this or that or the other, through the medium of the industry, we decided we should have a laboratory of our own. And this is cardinal to the beginning of the microwave committee. We first speculated that we should put it at the Army Air Corps headquarters, Bowling Field. Well, we worried about that a little bit. We did not want the military to breathe down our necks. We then considered putting it near the Navy Research Lab, also nearby. We decided that was dangerous. So we then were left with a quandary of where to put it. That is this hypothetical laboratory. So much for our earliest deliberations. I came no credit, but I was a little biased with respect to MIT. I had as a precedent the fact that World War I a special laboratory was set up through the management of the Bell Laboratories, right next door to their main laboratory at 463 West Street. That was where people could work for nothing. I'm talking about the top dogs in science, for instance. Some of us, at least on the microwave committee, were concerned about that, recognizing we couldn't forget the idea that we had nothing but industrial groups on the microwave committee, excepting for Loomis and myself. Now, I'll have to say, without direct evidence, that I thought it would be equally questionable if we put the responsibility of a laboratory under the management of the Bell Laboratories. That was a kind of off-the-record view, and there was no question there would be support from the other characters on the committee, because they were all from industry. There was only one conclusion. To me, it was the obvious conclusion. It would be wonderful if we could establish a laboratory at MIT. Granted, there was bias because we have other able institutions, but that's where I had my office and home and what have you. Now, the matter was how to handle this. I'm not bragging, I'm merely stating a fact, not a la North, but the problem now, on the main NDRC committee, among others, Bush as the head of it, Frank Jewett of the Bell Laboratories, and I need to enumerate the others, they're all on a letterhead, early letterhead, chemistry and what have you. So in my mind, if there was any obstruction, it would be Jewett of the Bell Labs. Jewett was president of the Bell Labs at that time. So I did go to see Bush to see if he would agree about MIT. Were MIT willing to take the job? And there are accidents of good fortune once in a while. It's unbelievable, but the next morning, after I knew Bush would approve MIT, Compton came to Washington on something else. And Jewett happened to be in Washington. So Jewett, Compton, Bush, Loomis, and I got together in Bush's office. And raised the hypothetical question about a laboratory and where should we have it. Jewett immediately spoke up with the utmost sincerity and said, now during World War I, we operated a laboratory right next to the Bell Company. We know about management, obviously, management of such a facility. Now, some one of us, I don't remember who it was, said, what about a laboratory at MIT? Well, Jewett braced himself and made what turned out to be a fatal mistake. Why, he said, MIT is a wonderful institution, but it doesn't know anything about management. Well, Compton bristled. That was an insult. He was truly offended. The idea that science, implying that the scientists at MIT, if you want to call them that, couldn't manage. That's all we needed. Bush sitting back quietly. Compton, very much upset. Started to ward off this business sort of an insult. Then Jewett spoke up in his defense instead of a Dr. Compton, or Carl as he was called. I didn't mean this as it may have sounded to you. I apologize. Of course, I recognize that MIT is a great institution. After all, he was on the board of MIT anyway. Loomis, with a certain amount of professional acumen, Dr. Jewett, I'm so glad you approved the idea of a laboratory at MIT before Jewett was able to say another word. And Bush had not been saying anything. He'd played coy. And Bush smartly accepted this. So it was determined by that rather this performance in semantics that the lab would go to MIT. Of course, Compton was delighted because he wanted it. Now, that's a pretty crude account, but that's what happened.
I'm a little unclear. When did the desirability for the need for a lab, when was it identified? Was it very early on in the deliberations of the committee? Was it thought about before the committee was
shall
composed?
May I make the usual remark? As chairman of the committee, theoretically neutral, I worried about any commercial group running the committee. It turned out subsequently that was a wise decision, because it helped us with the military later. I like to believe that any one of them would have taken the responsibility if it had been so ordained. But Bush didn't make that contribution of standing by and approving the decision once Loomis had tipped the scales. So I must give Loomis credit for that acumen that he had as a businessman to seize on the critical fraction of a second before Jewett finished his praise of MIT to get over the insult to Compton.
Well, that very well describes the sort of immediate decision to form the laboratory.
Right.
I guess I'm wondering, before that meeting, wasn't there a general feeling among the members of the microwave committee that they needed to establish a laboratory?
Oh, yes. No question. We had discussed that, say in chambers. Nobody of that group representing commercial companies stood up and said, we think we are competent to run the lab. Not a one of them. They were all anxious, I might say, to have it. That is, you had Bell Labs, Westinghouse, GE, and telephone company.
Well, you had developed a point of view that MIT...
We wanted a lab, and we wanted it separate.
Right, and that's...
From the committee.
Seems like a very astute decision. What I'm wondering is you had arrived at that deliberation at an early time.
Oh, yes.
How did you share that with the others in that meeting? What was your role in that meeting in putting forward the idea that MIT...
Bush's office?
Yes.
Well, in Bush's office, I thought before that that was a thing to do, and I thought of MIT as a reasonable place to get the to have the laboratory, provided Compton would approve. But one couldn't get Compton's approval without being sure that Jewett didn't come in and say they'd like to have the lab at Bell Laboratories.
So you, before this meeting in Bush's office, you had discussed this with Compton. Is that correct?
Nope. No. Not a word. I sound like North, but we hadn't. It's just an accident that we all were able to meet in Bush's office at the, what we might call the critical moment.
But had you, I would like to know about the NDRC Microwave Committee's relationship to the military at this particular juncture and time. Who, if you remember, who were your contacts within the Army and Army Air Force and the Navy about radar? Because the decision to, that you needed the laboratory hinged not only on the need to develop radar, it would seem, but on the possibility of developing it into a useful device for a set of customers, i.e. the military. You mentioned something very interesting early on, which said we would have to talk about the instrument landing, which is one of your big projects from
right.
the 30s,
mm-hmm.
which is where you met Arnold and King before they became, as you said, General and Admiral.
Yes, yes.
I would like to know if the connections you made in that project, and which were similar, analogous to connections that Dr. Draper, for example, was also making with the Army Air Corps in the 30s, with his turn indicator and his gyroscopic apparatus. Were those connections kept up? In other words, were you talking still to, I don't know what rank King and Arnold were, but were you still talking to them as the Microwave Committee was meeting and as you were seeing that radar had an immense amount of potential?
Let me be sure I understand. My hearing is not what it might be. Let's see if we can start it, do this step by step.
Please.
And then I'll try to answer it for you.
Okay.
I'm a bit bewildered. I'm not modest, but I am worried about throwing myself into it. I like to divine that I was an influence behind the scenes on this whole business. In other words, this was what we might call an arbitrary decision in having a lab and having it at MIT. We had discussed the idea of a laboratory. Our first view was that it would be prudent to have it near the Army Air Corps or the Navy. Now it happens that the Army at that time didn't appear to have any interest in radar. That's not doing them, that's doing them a disservice, but literally the Air was aware of the need, the Army Air Corps. And the Army Air Corps and the Army were not marching along together. So in effect, when I talk about this, I'm talking about the Army Air Corps vis-a-vis the Navy and then the Microwave Committee. Now before this time, we had already had available to us inspection of the Army Air Corps' work on radar under the aegis of their contract with the Signal Corps. We had access to the Navy's the research the Navy had placed in industry on radar. And there was no conflict with the idea of having a separate laboratory. Now, it didn't, fortunately, we didn't have any argument about it in the committee. It was kind of an informal committee. Each of the Army members watching the other. And I must say quietly that I already had a good relationship with the Signal Corps. I knew Admiral Bowen, had a good relationship with Admiral King, all on the basis of instrument landing. Now, I didn't sense any open opposition of the Microwave Committee in setting up a private laboratory. But they didn't want to get into a powwow with one another, I suspect, because they all had, they were really industrial representatives. They couldn't very well shed that individual cloak of their companies. And like, this isn't an argument, but it's a statement of what happened. They were sitting there kind of into a kind of a quasi-neutral situation, hoping some decision would be made. And a lot of this was dissolved in Bush's office by that meeting. I never heard any opposition, voiced opposition, as a result of deciding on the laboratory attack. That's not a good answer to your question, I'm afraid, but...
But it will do for right now. You've illuminated some very important points.
Now...
Let me just quickly just sort of restate part of Michael's question, and that is the perception at the time, given the amount of research that had already been done on radar, that the Microwave Committee and any organizations that it might establish could be successful in developing a working device?
None. I'm talking about the military, for one thing. They weren't antagonistic, but it was invading a sacred sanctum. I'm talking about the military point of view, both the Signal Corps and the Navy research lab.
They did not believe it was possible to build working, neither the Navy nor the Army Signal Corps at this juncture believed they could build a working device?
It is hypothetical. Now, I say that, let me go back to an illustration that may help in the history. For reasons I don't understand, Bush had put me on a committee of one of the foundations, a committee to worry about fog navigation. It had Jewett, a famous scientist from Ohio State, I'll think of his name in a minute, because this, I don't have anything else from the Parkinson's. It's a tendency to get a mental block.
You're thinking of Kettering?
No, I'll talk, when I come to Arnold, I'll talk about Kettering for you. Now, Mason, Professor Mason, the mathematical physicist at Wisconsin. Jewett, Mason, Captain George Freed, who was Commodore of the United States Fleet at that time, and myself.
This was a committee on fog navigation for a foundation?
I have a book, I have a reference to it I can look up. I don't remember the specific institution. It was one of the, like Carnegie Institution, or another body of that sort that Bush was mixed up with before the war.
Was perhaps the AIEEE?
Oh, no. This was this, kind of a it was like Carnegie, it was on a high level.
The Rockefeller?
I'll find it and put it in for you later.
Right, we can find that out later.
I don't want to waste your time, and Janet knows where what it is and can dig it out for me. Now, we went out to the Nantucket Lightship, the group. Spent the night there. And our emphasis was on sound, because that's, after all, what the warning they had on the ship, the foghorn. We got almost all the way to the ship before we heard the foghorn, and it was foggy. So that confirmed what generally is experienced by navigators, that you can't hear the damn stuff necessarily because of a refraction of the sound wave. And this group, we didn't have any cocktails, but we had a pleasant time together talking about this business. Captain George Freed said the place for a ship in fog is at anchor. That was his solution to the problem. But none of us thought of radar. When we came back to Washington, I don't remember whether it was Boston or Washington. I guess it was Boston who went out when we went out to the lightship in the Coast Guard boat. When we got back, the Normandy had been anchored in New York. That's the big French ship. They presumed to have a radio solution to finding obstacles in the fog. They were so fussy about it, and I have a hunch the Navy had a hand in it, that we were not permitted as a committee to get aboard the Normandy and see what they had. They were willing to have one person go, and Dr. Jewett was picked to go out there. And he did go out to examine the facilities. Now, it was radio. I can't tell you, because I don't know, whether it was pulsed radar, as in radar. But it was an aid of that sort. And in the literature subsequent to this time, you will find the French debating a bit on their contribution to radio detection in fog. Now, that was kind of drowned out by what the British overwhelming us with the news of their development of radar during the Battle of, preparatory to the Battle of Britain. My view from the whispers was that the Normandy did have a facility. Now, how precise it was as to direction, I can't say, but it was radio. I have no reason to believe it was not pulse radio. But by the time we got into radar within my purview, the Normandy had caught fire and burned in the harbor. And we heard a little about the rest of it from the French, because they were keeping that as a secret. And unfortunately, I can't detail it. I don't know. Sounding like Oliver North. But that is an experience that's a matter of history. And there's a record of this visit to the Nantucket Lightship of this group. At the time, here was one of our great physicists who had a lot to do with the telescope of Mount Palomar, a Wisconsin man, Mason. And on that trip, when the question of fog came up, how do you penetrate it with intelligence? Oh, he said infrared. That was a common belief, even among these would-be great physicists. Now, later, we did work at Round Hill, Round Hill Research Division, studying the effect of fog and rain on radio waves. And that's when it was clearly determined that infrared was not going to help us. That was assistance subsequently in finding out what fog might do to microwaves. It was useful when you get down to 3 centimeter microwaves. All I'm saying is that there was a lot of mental confusion at that time, even among physicists. It doesn't help you much, but that's a matter of history. It shows the stupidity of man, and I was one of them. I had a thesis going on at MIT on measuring distance by radio. It didn't occur to me that there was a parallel between sonar and radar. In other words, use of radio waves. I had a thesis boy doing a thesis on the intercontinental movement. The Navy came up here, sent a captain up to look over things and found out that I was doing this, and he went back in a mad rage, not rage, but he reported that somehow I was working on this ultra-classified stuff. I didn't have the acumen to visualize. I ought to use it for obstacle location. I recite that only to show how far off base we can get in our beliefs. I thought of continental movement because that was a thing of interest.
What do you mean by continental movement?
Thing that we talk about in the plates that they call them.
Oh, the movement of the continental plates?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So you were going to use radar as a precision?
My idea was to measure the movement of the continents, one with respect to another. It didn't occur to me that I ought to put my mind on obstacle location. Nothing brilliant about it, but it just shows the vagaries of the human mind. Well, now, the next big thing, in my estimation, was that the Tizard mission came over. Radar, of course, by that time was a big issue. We already knew what the Navy was doing from the research for which they had contracted. We knew what the Signal Corps was doing. Now, the Signal Corps was handling all the work for the Army Air Corps on radar. The Air Corps had no what you might call electronic section. When the Tizard mission came over, they brought with them one of their authorities on radar. Watson Watt declined to be a member of the group because he didn't think they could learn anything from the United States. Even he was the man who claimed credit for all radar and for history at its best, an ego or egomaniac, or whatever one wants to call him. But they did bring over a man by the name of, nicknamed Taffy Bowen, B-O-W-E-N. With the Tizard mission, they brought over what I first saw as one of these Boston briefcase, little bags, Boston bag. And in it was this magical device. Now, we knew on the microwave committee that we wanted to use microwaves, but we did not know how to generate them in any quantity.
Could we pause for a second and switch the tapes over?